From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Donvan in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Earlier this week, Amnesty International voted to support a policy that calls for the full decriminalization of consensual sex work. They say it's the best way to defend the human rights of sex workers, to lessen exploitation and abuse, and to make sex work safer. Opponents have come out fiercely against this move. They say that decriminalization would make sex work even more dangerous and would only protect pimps, sex buyers, and brothel owners. Lacking on both sides of this argument, strong evidence. Decriminalization is still very much an untested idea. This hour on Point, the case for and against decriminalizing the sex trade. You can join us on air or online. What do you make of Amnesty International's vote? Do you think that sex work should be decriminalized or not? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. So joining me first today from Paris, France, is Doreen Carvajal. She is Europe culture correspondent for The New York Times. Doreen, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John. Thanks for inviting me.
It's a pleasure to have you on. So talk us through this. What did Amnesty actually say this week?
Well, essentially, it's a policy that seeks no criminal penalties for the mostly female prostitutes and the buyers and the pimps. And as you said, Amnesty's concern is that these types of penalties expose prostitutes to increased human rights. But clearly, it's a divisive issue. And in the United States, there was a last-minute lobbying campaign by some celebrities and anti-sex trafficking groups to reshape the policy to keep or to impose penalties on buyers, like steep fines. But on the other side, many sex worker rights groups argue that punishing customers would drive prostitutes into the shadows, online advertising, et cetera, increasing the risks of violence and danger. By the way, this came about through a vote on Tuesday of about 400 delegates from all over the world, from Amnesty. They didn't release the size of the vote, but I'm told it was about two-thirds who voted in favor of this.
And how long has the controversy within Amnesty been cooking up?
Well, they've been consulting different country chapters or sections for the last 2 years. There's been a lot of discussion. There are particular countries that supported it, others that have great reservations. For instance, here in France, where I'm based, the French Amnesty chapter said this week that they will not lobby for this policy because they do not consider sex work. Those are Amnesty's terms, a job. They don't consider it a job. And today, the former head of Amnesty's Women's Committee in France published an open letter saying that she was ashamed of Amnesty. She argued that prostitution is violence against women because men pay for the use of bodies. So there's been a lot of discussion. I heard there was a very emotional debate in this closed conference earlier. There were tears. There were attempts to amend it. But in the end, you describe what the policy is now. No criminal penalties for the mostly female prostitutes and the buyers and pimps.
So what is the impact? Obviously, Amnesty International is not a government. It doesn't have enforcement ability. What difference does it make that Amnesty International has taken this position?
Amnesty is a leading human rights organization with a great influence and a great reputation. And just an example of what's happened in the last few days, a Washington, D.C. councilman is now proposing decriminalization in Washington, D.C., or at least he's floating the idea and said that it came to him in part after hearing what Amnesty had decided to endorse. I mean, they basically can campaign to lobby for their positions. But in this case, they've told me that they are not going to make this a global focus, that they will leave it to each country section or chapter to decide how they want to lobby or campaign for it.
So you're suggesting, Doreen, that its moral authority is enormous, but that it's not actually it's a little unclear to me. They're not actually going to take leadership on the position?
Well, it's unclear to me, too. I mean, maybe your guest from Amnesty International can explain a little bit better, but there seemed to be so much discussion about this that the compromise was that the different countries could decide which way they wanted to go, whether they wanted to lobby for it or not. And that basically is the power of Amnesty International, to lobby for change, to have a moral voice. But in this case, they're giving leeways to different countries to go the way they want. And that comes at a time that there's a real countertrend happening. Some countries are starting to move toward what is called a Swedish model. Mm-hmm. And in Sweden, prostitutes face no penalties. The customers are punished with steep fines. And this year, Canada and Northern Ireland adopted that model. And later in the fall, French legislators will vote on this as well. So you can see some of these amnesty chapters kind of reflect what's happening in their countries and they're responding to that.
Doreen, as you've pointed out, we have an official representative from Amnesty standing by from London, England, Catherine Murphy. She is the law and policy advisor at Amnesty International. And she actually helped to advise the legal and research aspects of this policy that was voted on and passed on Tuesday. Catherine, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John.
Hi. So, Catherine, what is the goal? What is the ultimate goal of the policy?
The policy aims to increase understanding of this issue globally and to set out our global position on this issue. And we spent the last 2 years, as Doreen pointed out, looking at this. We've done extensive research. We've looked at the research that already exists. And we've come to the conclusion that the best way to help to protect the human rights of sex workers, who are a group that are exposed to extreme levels of marginalization and abuse in many countries, is to support the decriminalization of consensual sex work. And just to add one caveat to that, is that does not include sex work where exploitation, coercion, or indeed trafficking, which is a different thing. So where exploitation exists in sex work, we do believe that the criminal law still has a role to play.
And you're not talking about legalization, which would be a few countries that practice legalization of sex work. The Netherlands and Germany actually have licensing procedures, et cetera, and laws that permit it and that guide it. So what is the difference for you between why not support legalization versus decriminalization?
Yeah, well, we spoke extensively to people around the world on this issue, including sex workers' rights advocates and sex workers themselves. And sex workers told us that they do actually have concerns about legalized systems. I think sometimes within legalized systems, governments choose to regulate sex work so narrowly that it can only be carried out in certain areas or in certain circumstances. And what that does in practice is that it can play into the hands of commercial operators more so. So you see sex work predominantly occurring in larger commercialized brothels, where in reverse of that, in a decriminalized system, what you do is that you decriminalize the sale of sex and the operational aspects of sex work, so that sex workers have much more power to work for themselves, to work together in informal cooperatives, to work together in apartments, and that actually the decriminalization model offers much more power to sex workers themselves, and that within a legalized model, that's not always the case.
The fact that, as Doreen was explaining, you're leaving it up to national chapters or national councils to decide whether to be active in pursuing local lobbying on laws on this one suggests that the organization itself doesn't feel fully behind what it's doing. Am I getting that wrong? What is it? What are the implications of that decision?
Yeah, I think to be honest with you, I think that's a misunderstanding of the way that Amnesty works. That's how we approach every issue that we have a policy on. This is our policy framework is used to state our global positions on issues, so this will become our global position on this issue. However, across the world, our sections look at their own environments and what the opportunities for change and campaigning are on different issues, and they set their own priorities. And that's how we work on every single issue that we work on. And there are lots of other issues that we have that we have a global position on that are potentially controversial. And we allow our chapters, as you call them, or our sections, to make the decisions about what's the priority for them, what do they think is a realistic opportunity for change in their country. For example, it may not be strategically possible or sensible for a section to immediately campaign for decriminalization of sex work in their country.
Let me ask Doreen.
I'm
sorry, Catherine. We're going to have to take a break shortly, but I wanted to ask Doreen before that. You're saying, Doreen, that in France the decision is made they're not going to push for it.
Yes, they're not going to lobby for this. They have great reservations about the new policy at the Amnesty International French chapter.
And does that also represent...
And as I mentioned...
Go ahead. You go ahead.
As I mentioned to you today, there was an open letter published in one of the French publications from one of the Amnesty International members who's long been active, saying that she doesn't, well, basically saying goodbye to Amnesty International. There's some division.
All right. Well, Doreen Carvajal, Europe culture correspondent for the New York Times, thanks so much for joining us. And Catherine Murphy at Amnesty International, please stay with us as we go through the break. We're talking about the controversy surrounding decriminalizing sex work. I'm John Donvan, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We're talking about whether or not sex work should be decriminalized and what the effects of decriminalization could be. So we're talking with Catherine Murphy. She is law and policy advisor at Amnesty International, and Amnesty International this week voted to adopt a policy that calls for global decriminalization of sex work in consensual situations. They are still adamantly against sex trafficking and abuse that can crop up in the industry. And Catherine Murphy, some of your opponents have suggested that the position that Amnesty has taken this week puts the organization in a position of actually promoting sex work. What's your response to that?
I think that's an unfair criticism. I think our policy recognizes that sex work occurs and that the people who are doing sex work around the world are often some of the most marginalized and discriminated against individuals on earth. And as a global human rights organization, we have a responsibility to those people, and we cannot ignore the abuses that they face. And this is difficult, absolutely, but we cannot ignore it. We have a responsibility to look at it and listen and see what is the best way to prevent these abuses.
Let's listen to what some of our listeners on Facebook are saying. Arminio Miranda writes, not only should it be decriminalized, but legalized so that it can be severely regulated to ensure the safety of sex workers so that they are not being exploited, abused, and can receive adequate health care. John Barba says, I do not agree, by which I think he means he does not agree with the amnesty policy. People are not objects to be bought and sold. This policy opens the door for a new slavery. We have another that says maybe it is just an admission or recognition of things we cannot control, which almost sounds like what the point you were just making, Catherine Murphy, that it's there already. But I'm also curious to know, I know that as you explained, you spent 2 years researching this, but in a sense, the notion of a global decriminalization, it's a leap. It's a leap into the unknown, it sounds like. There really is not a great deal of evidence to tell us one way or the other what the global impacts of decriminalization would be.
I mean, we do have some evidence. We do have models of decriminalization which are working very successfully in some places in the world, and the most prominent of which is New Zealand, where they have found that since decriminalization, the relationship between sex workers and the police has improved enormously, and that sex workers feel that they are now absolutely justified in going to the police to report abuses or violence against them, and that they are confident that when they do so, they will receive police protection and support rather than being pursued as criminals themselves or as accessories to crime, which is also often a problem. So we do have examples where this is working very well, and we are seeing really positive outcomes in New Zealand. I think also we have an enormous amount of evidence that the system of criminalization just is not working, and it is leading to human rights violations against sex workers. So we need to look at how we can change that.
Well, as you say, in New Zealand, it's been now about 12 years since they decriminalized the sex trade. And in an interview last year with CBC News, Catherine Healy, who is a sex trade workers' rights activist, talked about the changes that she herself has seen since decriminalization.
I remember sitting there with a sex worker when it was illegal who was reporting a rape, and the police officer reminded her that she was the one who was breaking the law. Extraordinary. And that a jury wouldn't find in her favour because they'd, you know, find it quite difficult to get their head around the fact that she was breaking the law and perhaps had put herself in the situation in the first instance. Now you would never hear of that happening.
Catherine Murphy, it's anecdotal, of course, but it seems to support your point that the sex worker in that case was empowered by decriminalization.
Yeah, and that's a very common story that we've heard in our own research, this concept that when sex workers report rape to the police, that the police are unsympathetic because they view it as either they're putting themselves at risk of this crime or that they're criminals themselves and it's not a police priority. And I think in a decriminalised system, that sends a very strong message to police that they have a responsibility and it is their job to protect sex workers rather than clamping down on sex work and pursuing sex workers as a means to prosecution.
Well, Catherine Murphy, I know you have to go. Thanks so much for joining us. You're the law and policy advisor at Amnesty International. Catherine, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, John.
So joining us now from Amherst, Massachusetts, is Taina Bien-Aimé. She is the executive director of the Coalition Against Trafficking Women. Taina, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. And also from New York, Kate Diadamo. She is with us as the National Policy Advocate at the Sex Workers Project. Kate, welcome to you.
Hi, John. Thank you so much.
Kate, I'll start with you because I find it interesting, and I think some listeners might find it surprising or counterintuitive that the overwhelming number of sex workers organizations such as yours that represent sex workers are completely behind what Amnesty is doing. And is that because, again, I was saying that the proposition is rather untested, and Catherine Murphy said, well, the evidence that criminalization doesn't work is pretty slam dunk. Is that because you agree with that perception?
Absolutely. We think this is really an important step towards accessing human rights for people in the sex trade and really respecting the basic dignity of people who trade sex. You know, there are criminalization structures across the globe, and they really do have the same evidence coming out that criminalization does make people more vulnerable to violence, to exploitation and trafficking, and unable to access resources. You know, as Catherine Healy was just saying, you know, reporting rape is a serious problem for a criminalized population. And unfortunately, the story that she told is far too common for everyone who has worked with folks who are trading sex. And so, you know, we see this as a huge step towards really accessing the full spectrum of human rights that people are far too often denied because they are in a criminalized population.
Let me bring Taina Bien-Aimé. Taina, as you've heard so far, I mean, the show has been stacking up, you know, one voice after the other saying this move is a good thing. And we know that for sure there are voices that are opposing that, and yours is one of them. What is wrong with the Amnesty argument?
So the Amnesty argument is in two parts. The first part of which we fully agree that people in prostitution, who are mostly women and anyone who identifies as a woman, is a highly marginalized group. They are very often brutalized by the police, certainly by their exploiters. men who purchase sexual acts, that this is a population that needs to be protected. Now, the human rights principles, starting with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, protects all individuals, including those in the sex trade. So the second part of Amnesty's argument is not only not necessary, but it flies in the face of human rights, in that what they're saying is that in order to protect the vulnerable, in order to save them from the violence that is prostitution, then you need to decriminalize their exploiters, the pimps, the brothel owners, and the sex buyers, which makes absolutely no sense. And it was really interesting to hear Catherine Murphy about her extensive research over the past 2 years, because we firmly believe that they only talk to the 2% who may enter the sex trade freely and willingly, but they don't speak for the 98%. And if you look at the draft policy that Amnesty issued, they refer to research. They don't cite the research. And we know, because we, the collective global women's rights movement around the world, have for the last 2 to 3 years tried to talk to Amnesty about listening to the voices of survivors, listening to the voices of women's rights groups, to no avail. So it's a very skewed research. We're looking forward to seeing exactly what their sources are, what their sites are, but it's clear that, we talk about stigma and violence, but prostitution is what marginalizes, stigmatizes, and creates violence. And reporting rape is a serious problem for any woman around the world, not just the women in the sex trade.
Well, let me just stop you for a moment, Taina, to bring in another voice that I actually think supports some of your argument. This is former sex worker Jenny Gaines, who was tricked into prostitution when she was a 14-year-old. She's now working with women in Minnesota through the advocacy group Breaking Free. And this is from an interview with the BBC where she talked about being manipulated as a young girl.
I started believing all the things that my trafficker told me, that I was born to be a hoe. I was born to do this. I was a natural. And I started believing all that was my worth. That was my value. My worth and my value was to sleep with men for money.
Let me ask you again, Kate, how that young woman would be served by decriminalization at this point, because it seems to me that her case goes much more to what Taina was discussing, which is victimization even by participation in the industry.
I mean, I think that those cases are very complicated and very complex, and that is a very small swath of a very full experience. You know, for folks who are victimized in the sex trade, criminalization does make it worse and does make it more difficult to unfortunately come forward. A lot of times when people are being exploited, it's easy to prey on someone when you can say to them, if you go to the police, you're more likely to be arrested. And they know that that's true, unfortunately, because they have an arrest record, because mm-hmm. they're undocumented, because they're, street-based youth looking for a place to sleep at night. But, what we're talking about here is decriminalization of the sex trade, not decriminalization of exploitation and trafficking. What we're talking about is a huge swath of individuals who are negatively impacted by legal policies. And, when we can talk at length about what that means for a lot of people around destigmatization, about bringing the conversation into the mainstream, about how criminalization is impacting individuals. And so, we talk about decriminalization of sex work, but people who are impacted by this policy across the board are negatively impacted by criminalization of pimping laws, which play out very differently on the ground than we often talk about them.
Very often,
pimping laws don't include things like exploitation in their definition. Mm-hmm. Often it's about sharing resources that you know were acquired through prostitution. And so, unfortunately, too often that means that people are isolated from working with their peers. They're isolated physically because they can't share space. They're isolated interpersonally because they can't talk about where their resources are coming from, or they can't share information, or they can't, share a place to sleep at night, or share food, or share money.
Let me take a point that you made back to Taina Bien-Aimé, and that was you you were drawing a distinction, I think, Kate, between sex work and sex trafficking, that these two things are not the same thing. And I want to ask you, Tina Bienaimé, can those two things be separated?
Yeah, you know, we're often accused of conflating both, but it's far from conflation, but they are linked, right? So sex trafficking is the means through which pimps, exploiters, and traffickers sell human beings into the sex trade. If there wasn't a vibrant sex trade, there would be there wouldn't be any sex trafficking. And the typical age of a child sold into the sex trade in this country is 12 to 15 years old. In India, it's 9 to 11. You don't magically have agency when you turn 18. Very often, most of the prostituted people live extensions of violence from their childhood, whether it's incest, homelessness, you're talking about gender and racial inequality. So, instead of focusing, you know, a lot of people talk about harm reduction, which is critical, but what we really need to focus is the harm itself. So there hasn't been that much discussion about the demands, like who are these men who purchase sexual acts? They are not nice men. They're not purchasing dates. They are purchasing violence. They're purchasing sexual harassment. They're purchasing the ability to exercise their sexual fantasies, no matter how dark and
let me ask,
horrible they
let
are.
Let me bounce off that and ask Kate D'Adamo, do you agree with that perception of the clients, that description of the clients?
You know, I think we can talk about the perception of the clients all we want, but what we really need to bring this back to is the impact of criminalization.
I actually would like you to address the perception of the clients, because that's where I think Taina is saying that crimes are being committed every time.
I think if a person declares that they are being exploited, declares that they are experiencing violence, then that should be absolutely criminalized and absolutely investigated and absolutely respected. You know, we have to respect the basic dignity and self-determination of people's experience. And so if they are in a violent situation with a client, then they should be able to report that to police.
But if I can just break in, Kate, I think Taina was making a more profound point that by nature, every single time the interaction is a form of abuse, may not be statutorily so, but it's a form of abuse, and therefore society should not decriminalize what the clients are doing, which is what Amnesty is calling for.
I mean, I think that those feelings about every single interaction that people are having are very valid. You know, people's feelings about prostitution and people's feelings about sex work are incredibly valid to have. And are widespread. You know, it is a very difficult topic. It is a very messy subject. And it is very uncomfortable when we're especially talking about people who have very limited circumstances and feel that they have to do this. And no one should be so limited that they feel like they have only one option. And no one should feel like they should have an option that is expressly violent.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
What Amnesty International is talking about is decriminalization and the impact of criminalization. And criminalizing buyers for folks on the ground who are trading sex makes things more difficult and more violent. And so, you know, everyone's feelings about this subject are incredibly valid and incredibly important. And the most important feelings that we should focus on are the people who are experiencing this and are the people who are impacted by this policy. And so, absolutely, people in the sex trade have a wide swath of experiences, and, you know, not all of them are positive. And, you know, there's a lot of negative feelings, a lot of complex feelings for people who are trading sex. And however they define their circumstances, however they define their experience, we need to respect that. We need to respect the basic human dignity of a person to say, this is the best option for me. Please just make it less violent. And so, you know, we absolutely should talk about why people end up in these situations. We need to talk about institutionalized marginalization. We need to talk about economic justice and homelessness and the violence that people are experiencing through poverty and through interpersonal relationships, through domestic violence. We absolutely need to talk about those things.
This podcast is sponsored by Casper. Casper is an online retailer of premium mattresses made in America. They're engineered for comfort and long-lasting support by combining premium latex foam and memory foam. It's outrageous comfort at a polite price. Here's the great part. Pick the one that is best for you and try it out, risk-free for 100 days, with free delivery and returns. Go to casper.com/onpoint and you can save $50. That's casper.com/onpoint. Now back to the show.
This is On Point. I'm John Donvan, and for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking about the movement to decriminalize sex work and the conversation around it, especially after the policy decision made this week by Amnesty International to adopt a position supporting decriminalization of the consensual sex trade around the world. We're talking with Taina Bien-Aimé. She is executive director of the Coalition Against Trafficking Women, and Kate D'Adamo. She is national policy advocate at the Sex Workers Project. And again, to ground ourselves in the reality of what we're talking about, an interview with ABC in 2012 where Talicia Espinoza is looking down at a picture of her that was taken when she was trapped as a sex worker and was talking about her experiences.
You know, I think about this picture. That day I probably slept with maybe 20 to 30 men. I've had to jump out of moving vehicles. I've had to run for my life. Girls that have been murdered, girls that have been abused and still had to come out into the streets.
We want to bring our listeners into the conversation. Let's go to Juniper calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Juniper, welcome to On Point.
Hi. I just want to point out your guest just said something about the average age of prostitution being 12. Many people cite this statistic, but it actually comes from a completely discredited study called the Commercial Sexual Exploitation of Children by researchers Estes and Weiner, who themselves have said that their study does not represent the actual experiences of commercially sexually exploited children. But that wasn't actually my entire point. I wanted to point out that people who are opposed to Amnesty's resolution have a moral opposition to prostitution. And I find it really interesting that these people who are very concerned with respectability politics are actually calling the very people they want to quote-unquote save pimps and pedophiles on the hashtag ICM2015, which was the Amnesty International hashtag. So there's a lot of abuse happening from the very people who claim to want to save us.
So when you say us, Juniper, are you a sex worker? Were you speaking in the first person?
I am.
So what, overall, what is your attitude towards what Amnesty is doing and the call for decriminalization? You're for it, I'm assuming.
I am for it, and I am just completely amazed that such a wonderful organization has made a statement that sex workers are human beings. The sex workers' rights movement has been going on for decades, and it's only recently that people are actually starting to listen to us. And it's really quite amazing.
But we've heard a lot said during the conversation so far about the extremely reported high rate of abuse, trafficking, abduction, et cetera. Are you denying that reality is there?
Oh, I don't think anybody would deny that reality. I mean, as we know, anytime you make something criminal, a criminal act, it only increases the amount of abuse that happens. And I think of people trafficked into the agricultural business, and we wouldn't talk about outlawing Taco Bell as a means of protecting those who are trafficked into the agricultural business, because we recognize that these are two very different populations with two very different needs.
All right, Juniper, thanks very much for your call. Let me take that to Taina Bien-Aimé. What do you make of Juniper's point, you know, the Taco Bell point, that in fact you're casting and she also made the point that Amnesty and others are taking have a moral opposition to prostitution per se by itself in all circumstances. It's an interesting challenge to your position. What do you make of it?
You know, we have to talk about race. We have to talk about health. We have to talk about violence against women and women's equality. Recently, Ken Roth, the executive director of Human Rights Watch, tweeted, "All want," and I'm quoting, "all want to end poverty, but in the meantime, why deny poor women the option of quote-unquote voluntary sex work," his words. So you have to wonder whether this most prominent human rights organization like Amnesty would extend that argument and say, well, why don't poor men enter voluntarily into debt bondage or poor children into sweatshops? So somehow violence against women is an exception to human rights when it comes to these organizations like Amnesty, Human Rights Watch, and SOAR's Open Society Institute. If you look in this country, the overwhelming race of people who purchase sexual acts are white. The overwhelming representation of people in the sex trade selling sex are women of color, African-American women. In Canada, it'll be First Nations. In New Zealand, it's the Indigenous and Aboriginal populations, and just to contradict Catherine Murphy, actually street prostitution has doubled according to the New Zealand government since the decriminalization. So we have to really look at the issue as to why is prostitution, which we believe is inherently violent, an exception to human rights. And we fully agree that criminalizing people who sell sex should end. We fully agree that these are individuals who need medical, housing, educational opportunities, that they should not be further traumatized or abused or raped by law enforcement and others. But again, decriminalizing their exploiters, decriminalizing the men who purchase sexual acts, the pimps, is really it's Kafkaesque. I mean, it's just it flies in the face of human rights. And anybody who has Google should look up the German experience, where prostitution was decriminalized, the sex trade was decriminalized, and now you've got countrywide brothel chains where you have Friday night specials for €69. You can have all the bratwurst, beer, and women you want.
All right, let me stop you at that very vivid image and take it to Kate DiDama. What about the German experience? And let's talk a little bit about what Sweden has tried, Kate. They have come up with a legalization program in Germany and a sort of semi-criminalization program in Sweden.
Absolutely. And I will say that decriminalization and legalization, as said in the beginning, I'm sorry, I can't remember who described it, but they're two different structures. And people in the sex trade are not for, generally, legalization. They're for decriminalization. And so I think that conflating multiple models which have elements of criminalization which people are opposed to and which people do declare harms from is really taking us away from the conversation of decriminalization, where New Zealand and New South Wales have implemented decriminalization and have seen great results, have seen what is, the healthiest sex industry in the world. They do have better relationships with law enforcement. And so all of the indicators of improvement are in decriminalization models, not so much so in legalization models for the variety of reasons that were already pointed out. But I do want to go back to one thing that Taina stated, where, you know, the premise of so much of this is this idea that prostitution is inherently violent. And unfortunately, fortunately, people in the sex trade do not necessarily assume that. You know, trading sex for resources is something that a lot of people do across a wide range of circumstances and in a wide variety of ways. And so, you know, if we take away this notion that for every single experience, for every single person, it is inherently violent, I think that changes the conversation.
What do you mean by that wide variety of ways? I mean, how broadly are you describing that exchange of sex for resources? Are you talking about traditional marriage and dating?
I mean, you know, that I think is a different conversation. You know, people who trade sex, people involved in the sex trade, have a constellation of experience that is vastly changing. You know, we at the Sex Workers Project, we get to work with people across the spectrum who are involved by choice, who are involved by a wide range of circumstances, as well as people who have been trafficked into the sex trade. And their stories are complex. Their relationship with these things are very complex. And they can change day to day. You know, if you are someone who says, this is the best option for me because I'm a student. This is my only option because I'm undocumented. This is my best option because I'm a parent. And, you know, access to childcare is very, very difficult. That is a decision. And maybe the next day your car breaks down. And all of a sudden you need $500 that you don't have, or you get sick and you can't work for 2 weeks and your rent is due. And all of those have different pieces attached to them. So sometimes it can feel like, I don't want to do this, but I have to because I don't want to lose my housing. And sometimes it can feel like, you know what, I have all of my bills paid and I don't have to do this, but I'm going to choose to feel a little bit better and a little more stable financially. And so, you know, people's experiences can change day to day, can change client to client. And that includes people who have been trafficked. A lot of people who have come through our program who have experienced trafficking, you know, have remained in the sex trade because that was what they knew and that still felt like their only option. Mm. Were in the sex trade before and, you know, they were at that point 14 and homeless and trading for a place to sleep. And then because they were in a precarious situation, were then exploited after that. You know, people's anytime you have informal labor, which is providing a social safety net that people don't have access to, it's going to be a very complex, very difficult situation. And so I think writing all of it off as violence is very dehumanizing.
Let Taina respond to that.
Yeah, but what you're saying is that you're describing women in domestic violence situations as well. You know, consent is a very, very tricky concept in women's rights because it doesn't recognize the imbalances between those who have power and those who don't. So, you know, if you look at the concept and notion of agency and consent in our fight against rape and sexual violence, where, well, you consented to let him in, to go into that bar, you consented to going on the street with a short skirt, you married him, and what a shame that you married so poorly, or et cetera. We have moved on to recognize that rape and domestic violence are human rights violations based on gender-based violence and discrimination against women. And prostitution is just an extension of that. It's not an exception to violence. It is not. And again, I think we fully, fully understand the complexities of women and others who find themselves in the sex trade. But it's not choice. It's an absence of choice. And we really need to be creative to find alternatives for people than to have to be subjected to men who purchase sexual fantasies. Whether you are in a car or whether you are in a fancy hotel, when that door shuts, you have no idea what you bargained for. Your power of negotiation to not get raped, strangled, spit on, defecated on, every orifice of your body being used is out the window. And again, just to go back, we fully understand that it's extremely difficult for prostituted women to go to the police, which is why we are trying, you know, Demand Abolition and other groups in the country are really working very hard with law enforcement to sensitize them to the fact that they should no longer arrest prostituted individuals, that these are people who require services, and that we really need to focus on demand.
I'm going to stop you there, Taina, just because I want to bring in a few more listeners, and Casey is calling from Bettendorf, Iowa. Casey, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John.
Hi.
I just wanted to make the point that for tens of thousands of years, humanity has been passing its genes on largely through rape and aggressive sex. So there are a lot of, you know, men and women who have aggressive sexual wants and needs. And my feeling is if we give them a legal outlet for that, I think in Delaware about a dozen years ago, they saw that one of their laws had essentially legalized prostitution as long as it wasn't outside or something. And within a year or two after that, rapes, or at least reported rapes in the state, went down precipitously. And after they recriminalized it, the rates started going up again. So it seems to me like it's a release valve almost for some of the really more base and aggressive instincts that have been bred into us over.
But Casey, would you want to be on the receiving end of that transaction?
Well, there's a sort of a 50 Shades of Grey culture here where I think a lot of women, to a certain degree, and there's a range of, you know, likes and dislikes. There's a range of women who do enjoy that. There's a range of men who don't enjoy that. I mean, there's a range of, you know, there are large ranges on both sides, and legally, you know, putting a legal framework on it would make it easier to match up, say, providers who want to put themselves out as saying, yes, I am a more aggressive provider or whatever, and, you know,
All right, Casey, thanks for your point. I think that we do get the point, and thank you for giving us a call in. Mike is calling from Providence. Welcome from Providence.
How are you, Mike? John?
Good, thank you.
How are you? Yeah, Providence was the last state to have legal prostitution, and I just want to make a few quick points just based on what I observed. The age of consent in Rhode Island was 16 years old, so what strip clubs were essentially brothels. And I remember walking out of the theater one day with my wife and seeing an out-of-state car pull up, and young high school-age wimp girls came out. They were probably 16, 17, 18 years old, and they were being funneled into the back of what it was essentially a brothel. It was a strip club. And Rhode Island became a magnet for trafficking, and because we actually attracted the type of people that your guest is explaining, people who wanted to seek out the ability to legally violate women. And this gentleman that just called Casey, I don't know what point he was making, but I think he was trying to make the salient point that legalizing rape is okay. And I just, as an individual who lived in a state, and thankfully we got rid of prostitution a year ago, it was basically organized crime funneling young girls in so that people could live out their violent fantasies. So I'm really concerned that Amnesty International went as far as legalizing this, or not legalizing, but supporting this, and they should really rethink their position.
All right, Mike, thanks very much for your call. I usually like to give the last word to our guests, but you got it because we're out of time. But both of our guests are still here, so I want to thank them. Taina Bien-Aimé, Executive Director of the Coalition Against Trafficking Women. Thanks so much for joining us, Taina.
Thank you.
And Kate Diadamo, she is National Policy Advocate at the Sex Workers Project. Kate, thanks to you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, Jeb attacked Hillary, Trump attacks Fox, Ferguson after a year, and China devaluing its currency. It will be our weekly news roundtable when we go behind the headlines. I'm John Donvan, and for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.